Menders, episode 27, moving from anxiety to empowered with Ramses Rodriguez.
If we really think about it, the people take the president of the United States, they have the same 24 hours we do, and somehow they're running countries, right? So it puts a little perspective in, like, how do we leverage our 24 hours to have our version of a full-rounded life?
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team? Sustain your momentum as a leader and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Well, welcome to Menders. Today we have Ramses Rodriguez. And Ramses, you're an anxiety master coach instructor, and you work with high-performing individuals, some of whom suffer from panic attacks and anxiety, and you're really focused on folks who are in the science-based, or at least my memory is that you're working with a lot of folks with a science background, and you focus on evidence-based and holistic modalities. You've also got a master's degree in developmental genetics, and you combine science, theory, and alternative therapies in your work. And just because I'm delighted to talk about you, you've also written two books, and I'm so excited to hear that you're working on a third. But your first book is Stop Pressing Your Own Panic Button. Your second is The End of Writer's Block, and I'm going to link these in the show notes so everybody can read them as well. And I'm excited to hear about your new project. You're training folks in a Panic Freedom Academy, and you're coaching professionals on how to overcome panic attacks. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I'm a fan. I was listening in the background when I reached out to you. I was like, this is so good.
I am so honored. I know I think you're my number one fan, actually. Thank you for agreeing to be on today. And I invited you to talk with me really about a few things, but the primary theme is learning how to recognize what our bodies are telling us about our values, especially when we're high performing, you know, healthcare leaders or healthcare professionals, and we start running into body blocks, or our bodies start giving us information. And to me, that's like a major clue that there's something that's not working. And I think a lot of folks experience that in healthcare, but we don't often address that. So I would love to dig into that with you today.
Ooh, this is fun. I have a lot to say because part of my whole journey to becoming an anxiety master coach was my own journey in the science space. You said earlier in the intro, which thank you, by the way, lovely introduction. I'm blushing. You said that I was a geneticist, and I was. I went to school for genetics, and I did a master's. And I remember getting my first gig out of grad school and, you know, designing cancer diagnostic tests, of all things. And I remember how intense there was, this publish or perish mentality and this fast pace of always producing. And I remember that's when my anxiety was at an all-time high. And then I had a lot of symptoms that came from that. And the thing that always made an impact for me mentally was this whole idea that if I really looked carefully, it was almost like my overextension of my boundaries were praised. There was like this hustle culture that was, you know, uplifted, and hey, you stayed extra and you got this extra thing done. Even if it was obvious that it was at the expense of my own body.
So help me understand, how did you start to notice that you were being caught in that kind of reinforcement cycle?
Well, unfortunately, the way it happened was the panic attacks got so bad. So my body, and I think this happens to a lot of people with anxiety and anxiety-induced physical symptoms, that it starts to knock at the door, so to speak, the actual anxiety. And for me, it showed up as full-blown panic attacks. I'd show up to the lab in a panic. And there was one time I ended up in the hospital. I remember I was shaking so bad I could barely identify myself. And by the time I was in the ER, they had an Ativan drip in my left arm and I was knocked out. So from that moment on, I knew it was pretty severe because I'm now leaving work. It's now affecting my performance at work. And at that point, I had to pause. I had gone to psychiatrist and they put me on Xanax. And at that point, I used the time I was on those medications. They gave me some, use as needed. And I started to get to work. I started to research. I'm going to touch everything and anything that talks about anxiety, whether it's Eastern, Western, etc. And I'm going to really figure out what exactly is happening because I almost couldn't control or predict the anxiety, the panics. And it was then when I started to do this research, you take a step back and you're like, I'm in this, dare I say it, machine, so to speak. At least it feels that way, right? And that's when I really started to piece it together. I was like, I'm participating in this thing that has so much momentum. I don't even know how to stop it. So how do I either back out or how do I take care of myself while I'm participating in it? And those were my big goals at the time, was at the very least get my health back in check. Because without me, without me being healthy or being able to function, my work, stops. I couldn't do anything else.
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today. Wow. Yeah. I really appreciate you sharing that. And I just want to say, I was not typically someone who experienced anxiety myself. And then I had a baby and experienced postpartum anxiety and panic attacks, which I think was partly related to be like a history of burning out and like progressive burnout. But those panic attacks for me started after I returned to work, and I didn't fully get a hold of them myself until I actually switched jobs and just left a system that was really, I think, also promoting overwork for myself. So I'm really identifying and appreciating what you're sharing. And I think that experience you're describing is pretty, I don't want to say standard, but like relatively common within healthcare.
Yeah, I had a client, he worked with me. He was having some level of performance anxiety. That was a very personal thing he needed to accomplish. He was doing this project and he couldn't get it done. And when he reached out to me, I think one of his first words were something like, I normally don't ask for help, but... And that little bit of a phrase really got burned into my brain, because I was pre-med. The reason I became a geneticist is because I had been planning to go to medical school. And in undergrad, I worked at a nursing in nursing team. I was a nurse's aide, right? A PCA, they called them in my hospital. And I remember there was this level of performance and getting it done and don't be weak and don't ask for help. If not, you're kind of a nuisance or you're not up to scruff with your skills. And showing fatigue was not great. I don't know. There was a lot of that. So when he told me that, I was like, I sort of remember this. I remember, obviously I was not a physician, but I remember being in that hospital setting, in the healthcare setting, and realizing a lot of those pressures, and it's almost not spoken, which is the insidious part, right? No one's saying, don't take your break. No one is out. Well, maybe actually there were some nurses. Yes. Sometimes it is all right. But in a lot of cases, it's almost as though I want to call it a system. The system itself is set up to endorse burnout. Ooh, that feels hard to say out loud. I've never really said it that way, but it almost seems that way. And the thing is, because this whole entire thing is set up that way, it feels like you're rocking the boat if you step out of line. And if you rock the boat, your career is at stake, stigma, all the things associated with it, like I said, weakness. So when he reached out to me, starting off with those lines, I was like, okay, there's a thing here that's deeper than just anxiety, right? And so sometimes there's the shame of having anxiety and then the shame of actually directly managing it. And then the second part is the uncertainty of what exactly is it? Because sometimes anxiety shows up as burnout or other physical symptoms.
So I work with a variety of healthcare leaders and different leadership teams. And I met with a pretty large group earlier this week. And one of the themes that came up that I thought was really interesting was feeling like they had essentially been voluntold into these leadership positions, which I know is not everyone's experience. But the thing that seemed to be coming along with that was a sense of anxiety, you know, anxiety about their ability to perform their job, you know, maybe bordering on imposter syndrome, anxiety about their ability to support their people, and this sense that they didn't necessarily have the support or training or resources to fully do that in the way that they wanted to. And then I think the third piece that I heard was this sense of pressure to engage in self-sacrifice and ignore their needs because they are trying to take good care of their people. Like, they really care about their employees. But I just heard the sense of challenge and suffering that went along with that. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about, you know, working with high-performing leaders or people who are in these kinds of positions where they're trying to care for others and struggling to care for themselves.
Yes. This question drives it home for me because when I left the genetics lab, I ended up starting my practice, but also I was working in the publishing industry in nonfiction books, and I became the vice president. So here I am now, one of those high-performing leaders managing anxiety. At that point, I was already really into my anxiety work and all the things that I've done. And so it was a lot easier for me to see when I'm being pushed towards getting out of my comfort zone or violating a boundary of my time. And I started to think, how could I keep... Because there is a thing we start to realize as you're quote-unquote growing, climbing the ladder. How do I still strategically grow? I don't want to cut my growth. I don't want to cut my growth. But how do I also take care of myself? Because we can tell we're drained. We go home with the problem, or we're not sleeping right, or you know, that anxiety fog at the desk. I mean, I've sat at my desk sometimes when there's so much happening to go check emails, and I'm like, wait, what was I doing again? I just like stare at my computer for a little bit, and I'm like, what is going on? So we start to see these things happen to us. So what I started to do was, how do I create a lifestyle as a high performer from with what I can do right now? And my trick was the calendar. This is an interesting little trick I figured out, was when I started to realize my calendar was like my sacred space, it was my promise to myself, I realized that if I set my calendar to you can't see details and you basically can see when I'm free or busy, I can block in my breaks and my vacations and my naps and anything I needed to take care of for myself first. And then I scheduled in other appointments. And when I did that, I was like, oh, there is a way to, at least from the tools I have accessible to me, to start making my life a little bit more centered around my own health. So my lunches were prioritized, my breaks were prioritized, my time at home was prioritized, and I would physically block them off. And then when someone said, hey, could you stay extra? I could actually look at my phone and say, you know what? It looks like I have something there. And that boundary becomes so easy to set, and we don't feel like we're lying. So that's just a little hack, I guess, that I came up with, because it is important to us. It's important that we do grow. We didn't get into these careers because we didn't care about people. But how do we make sure that we're still honored? And when we set up a life with just the simple things that we have, we could start actually seeing a light at the end of the tunnel in terms of our own health. But then there's the systemic part. That feels like an uphill battle sometimes.
That is exactly where I was going to go. The question in my mind was, well, first of all, I have to say, I love your system. I need to adopt that because I am not good at prioritizing that at all. So full confession. And I recognize that's important. But I mean, the question that comes up for me is, how do we find that balance, or how do you help high performers to find this balance between self-care and, you know, living within a system that can at times reinforce us for doing things that are highly problematic, that you know, do go against our core values or are not good for us? Like, I know, I'll just give a brief example. This is pre-pandemic. You know, my healthcare system was basically like, are you dead? No? Great. Then you need to be at work. You know, doesn't matter if you're sick. And this was in a medical center. So, you know, no one should be working sick in a medical center. But the culture at the time, and this really has changed since COVID, was come in no matter what. Right. And so for me, the last couple of years have really been a mental retraining of even just that very simple thing of, when I'm sick, I don't go treat patients, or, you know, I'm not going to go have an in-person appointment with a coaching team. I'm going to have that boundary. And it seems so simple, but it's also been a really big hurdle for me mentally to, you know, make that transition.
Yeah. There's a couple things that I want to say to this as to how we can all really start to, you know, nudge that dial, so to speak, on this whole systemic, you know, way of idolizing, I guess is a word, this hustle culture. I do think the most obvious solution is the most simplest one, and we'd have to start with ourselves, because we would be that one tick to change first. It's that whole quote, I believe it's like, be the change you want to see in the world sort of thing. Only because, it's not me saying this because it sounds pretty, because it does, it's a cool quote. It's only because it's a functional thing. If we're not taken care of first, we really can't do that work. We can't go in and start affecting change. So I would say that's the first place to start. And with respect to anxiety, the key is to get clear first on what, at least in my work, what, how does it show up for you? Like getting an actual name to all the different ways it shows up. Does it show up as procrastination, fog, physical symptoms like jittering? Like what exactly is that? So I always say, start off with what I call a profiling phase. You got to get clear on what are these different ways anxiety shows up. Is it distractibility? Is it fatigue? Is it all of that? Making a list of those things. And then I always say, go follow up with your physician and make sure nothing scary is happening. Like go actually rule out all the scary stuff. But then you're left with this list of, this is the way anxiety is actually showing up. Now that we know how your anxiety shows up, then you could do something specifically for your version of how it manifests. And I call that the diffusing the trigger stage. So that second phase is all about, if you have catastrophizing thoughts happening, there are tools for that. If you have sensitivity issues like sensory processing sensitivity for someone who's empathic or an HSP, there are tools for that. And if you have legit boundary issues where it's scary for you to say no, or for you to, you know, because that could also be a cultural thing, right? How do you get the specific tools for the way anxiety shows up for you? And then the last phase is coming up with a plan that's like a maintenance. Once we know how it shows up for you and you have your specific unique toolkit, now setting up how it's going to be implemented in your day to day. So when I said the calendar hack, that was an example of me saying, I have figured out what my triggers are. I don't know how to say no in a conversation. It's uncomfortable for me sometimes, but it's easy for me to pull up my phone and say, oh, I actually have that time blocked off. Yes, it's a 2-hour nap for myself, but I could say it's blocked off, right? And so that ends up being ways to actually implement those tools that you've learned. We know we have to set the boundary. How do we do that? Because ultimately, anxiety comes in different phases. And what I had found was through talking to therapists, working with coaches, there were three main areas that contributed to the level of anxiety we normally have in our day-to-day. I call that level the anxiety baseline. So fancy, but your anxiety baseline. It's determined by mental components, physical, and environmental, right? And so when you have a place to go look for these ways that anxiety is being promoted in you, even in your work, even as a high performer, we could look at those three categories and develop that list. And now we have a place to start. Now we know what to specifically help you and your unique situation with. Because there are tools therapists can give you, there are tools coaches can give you. And I do distinguish between the two. Mm-hmm. And so there are many things you can, but are we just, you know, shooting blindly at a dartboard, or can we just specifically help you from where you are and with your worries and the things that actually matter to you? So three phases: profile it, diffuse it, then maintain it. Mm-hmm. So fancy.
I love the fancy. So I have a couple questions, but the first question that stands out is, what do you think panic means or stands for, like from a cultural perspective? Like what function do you think it's serving within healthcare, but just within, you know, maybe US society?
Ooh, I have so many thoughts on this.
I know it's a big question.
It is, because my brain, you know, as you introduced me, I like to look at the holistic and the science-based thing. So my brain immediately goes to my science training and I'm like, oh, there's a lot of physiological things happening in your brain when you have a panic attack. And there's a lot of neurological things happening. And understanding that, yes, it is a cascade of physical symptoms, an actual panic attack. Putting that aside, I like to think about, I believe in psychology, it's called secondary gain. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a term that I learned with my therapist. The secondary gain is something I really like to look at, because when we have such extreme anxiety and extreme panic attacks, it's a big stop sign. It ends up serving us because it's such a obvious visual experience that we can set a boundary so quickly by saying, by the way, my body's freaking out, I actually can't do that. So it has like that secondary backdoor gain of, I could set a boundary easily if my default physiological symptom is a panic, right? And I ask my people this. I'm like, hey, if you were to guess, how does anxiety serve you? What would that guess be? And when you really think about it, of course, there's physical symptoms. There's real triggers. Those things are for real, for real. And also, how do we leverage that? If it were a tool, in what way are we leveraging it, right? And that feels fun, because then we like, oh, it's helping me fulfill the need of boundaries, the needs of my health, the needs of my time. And I say, okay, now that we know how that panic and anxiety is serving us, that secondary gain, why don't we just develop systems in our lives that meet those needs directly, instead of having that anxiety be the thing we manipulate our environment with, right? And that's kind of hard for someone who has panic attacks to hear. So I would never go right in and say that, because, you know, truth be told, it is still a very real physiological experience when someone has anxiety. But, you know, in that almost metaphysical sense, you have to wonder, what would be a purpose in manifesting this situation over and over? And when we really look at it, I think, you know, we could look at the high performer. We need an out. This is an easy way where our body just says, by the way, no more. No more. So that would be how I think anxiety and panics, that's what I would think it is in that sense.
I mean, that makes so much sense to me. So, and I know I have personally experienced similar things. And I'm thinking of a relatively recent time where I was, I think, just feeling a tremendous amount of like physical heaviness, and, you know, just felt so down and blah, and like physically weighed down. And then I realized, like, oh, I am coming up with this interpretation of this situation to make myself right. And to be right, I have to feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And it was so funny, because the moment that kind of clicked in my mind, the heaviness was totally gone. It was just evaporated. So it was so clearly a product of my cognition. But I would not necessarily have gotten there, you know, without some friends and thinking it through, and kind of a willingness to really reflect on my experience and how that experience was serving me.
Yes, yes, yes. It's so true. And to add to that, a thing I like to contemplate a lot is, you know, part of the reason this has become so systemic is there is somewhat of our willingness to participate in it. Because that also has a secondary gain. That also has its benefit. To be part of a group means you're not an outcast. And if your brain recognizes you could be in a group rather than an outcast, it perceives that as likelihood of survival. it kind of doesn't allow for that primitive part of our brain to say, hey, if I'm an outcast, I have a likelihood of being hunted or killed, right? It kind of calms that down. So when we realize that this is partly a survival instinct to be part of the in-group, we can also start to say, hey, if this is a primitive part of our brain, we do have very developed part of our brains that can override that. And so just having that awareness and realizing that part of our anxiety or part of our desire to continue something that's established so that we're accepted is a very much survival driven thing, then we could say, oh, but we're really not being hunted, and I could speak up for myself and I won't die. right? And then really realizing that anxiety is an indicator that some kind of fight, flight, or freeze response is possibly present, we could take a step back and realize, hey, you're actually not in danger. So that little realization there that lets you start to see things differently, that you're not actually in harm if you just speak up and advocate for yourself.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm curious, what do you see working with your clients when that clicks for them? How do they transform? What is the outcome? What do you see as different in terms of how they honor themselves, set their boundaries?
Yeah, well, they feel like a different person is the common thing. Because I have this conversation outright with them. There's a point where their anxiety becomes managed and they notice, and it'll happen super suddenly. They're like, oh my God, I haven't had a panic attack in weeks. And then they'll come to one of our sessions and they'll be like, I just realized I haven't had a panic attack for 4 weeks. And then I always ask them, and do you continue to need that panic attack?
Wow.
Right. And then I ask them, what about your identity did shift? Because as you know, you're not panicking, but people around you will also stop seeing you as the anxious person. Because we do start to assimilate with the anxiety and panics and that persona of the anxious person. And when we don't have that persona anymore, who are we, right? And so what you start to see is that they are behaving differently. They just have more energy. Sure. But it's, how do I say this? It's the attitude. The attitude shifts just a little bit, not off-putting. It's just, I call it this empowered kind of feel, this vibe, this energy that they develop. And they almost don't even have to set boundaries at that point because they get so clear on their preferences that they just move away from things that don't work for them and move in towards things that do. And that conversation is not even being had. I often ask them, I said, do you think someone asks me if they're allowed to yell at me? And do you think people yell at me? And they're like, no, I can't imagine anyone yelling at you. I was like, that's right. I just don't. It's just not part of my energy anymore. It used to be because people used to yell at me, right? And so it ends up being this whole like, how much of my anxiety was embedded in my identity? And when I solve that anxiety and get it managed, how has my identity shifted? And they will see that for the better. It's never worse. It's always, oh my God, I feel empowered. Oh my God, I can go to work and not be burnt out. Oh my God, I can grow and not feel guilty about it. And that feels so good. Now they're in a position to impact change, right? Because you're healthy. You're good. You can show up to work and be fine. For me, being the vice president of that company, there were lots of things happening. And it was very high ticket. It was a very boutique, high ticket situation. So there was a lot of money at stake for everything. And so the pressure was on, but I was like, that pressure is not mine. That's not my pressure. Having a different relationship with my anxiety really made that happen. And it really started with just this basic work I had done on myself that I hadn't realized was an actual system that could be taught over and over and over again.
So one of the things I'm hearing there is that when you take full responsibility for yourself, your own experience, kind of own your values, your energy, how you are, your identity, and allow that to transform and let go of what you don't need, it shifts how you're interacting with others. And I'm curious what you'll think about this, but what I'm hearing is like, you stop trying to manage how other people interact with you. They are just naturally shifting because you are different in the system.
Yes, that's exactly. You heard it right. I'm glad you heard that because I'd said a lot of words. But yes, you're managing through managing yourself in a weird way. You know, and it can be overwhelming. Our brains are the place where we perceive things, but it's also the place where all the thoughts are hanging out. So a lot is happening in there all at once. And a lot of the diffusing phase, that second phase, has to do with parsing out where and how you're going to make sense of what we're bringing to the table versus what we're perceiving. And that ends up being a big area where of practice. There's a lot of tools, and it doesn't matter what modality it comes from, whether it's therapy or coaching tools. There are many tools out there for them. The thing that I'd found was if you're using the wrong tool for the wrong kind of things that are coming up for you, there is a mismatch, and then people, it becomes frustrating. It could be, you know, I remember many people saying, you're just going to be an anxious person. Here's your Xanax. Live with it. while that might be exciting for some, and please, 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 and I like to say this in every interview, I never don't advocate for a therapeutic that would be working for someone. That's not what it is. It was the absolutism in their voice saying, you have to be this way and there's no solution. That is what I was like, huh. I don't know. I don't take no for an answer. And I guess part of what helped me figure this stuff out was a little bit of my stubbornness to take no for an answer in a way. But yeah, when you start to really get clear on that difference between what we're perceiving versus what we're bringing to the table in our brain, that entanglement itself brings clarity and clears up a lot of the mental chatter. Often the cognitive dissonances, did I perceive that? Is that real? Or am I making it up? This is true for very sensitive people. So if you're someone who identifies as an empath or HSP, there's a lot of that dialogue happening in the brain, and it takes a lot of processing power. And when the brain is busy, it causes stress. And when there's stress, the anxiety is up, and it becomes this cascade. So taking a step back, looking at ourselves and working with where we are helps us show up into this system that feels, you know, not designed to chill, not designed to relax into solutions. And we could affect that change. We could be the one that relaxes into a solution. We could be the one that meditates and comes up with something rather than being at our office for 4 hours, which, by the way, has never worked for me. I've just been so tired, and it looks like I'm working, and I'm just at my desk, like, trying to stay awake. I think we can create from a different space, and I think our world is evolving into a place where it can be tolerated.
Wow. So really, you don't have to stop being someone who is emotionally sensitive or sensitive. You can still function being yourself in these more challenging circumstances. And I have certainly worked with people who have been told, like, you shouldn't have even gone to medical school because this is a really stressful environment, and that's the way it is, kind of that absolutist way of thinking. And I think the same with healthcare leadership generally. You know, it tends to be a field that is burning people out, and there can be a perception that that is the way it is, that that's okay. And that if you can't hack it, you need to get out. But I think, like, for me personally, I think it is actually so critical to bring in a more diverse group of people, or people who, you know, may not be in that majority power perspective, or have all of the, you know, like the macho skills that might make it easier for them to interact in that way, but who are so critical because they can actually promote transformation or healing relationships or a new way of doing things. So I guess you just have my brain thinking about, how do we create space for those people on an individual basis, but systemically too?
Yeah, it's very true. I think one of the things that can be very helpful is bringing to light all the research about the strength of people who are sensitive. The first term I'd learned about sensitivity was through the lens of empaths. And I would say it's probably more spiritual language. But then I jumped into the HSP research, highly sensitive people. And that realm is more of, this is what's being studied at a scientific level. And they find that the trait that HSP has is something called sensory processing sensitivity. And they now look at genetic analysis of what is the neurodivergence happening, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the lead researchers says, you know, it's funny, whenever you see an article about a sensitive person, it's like, well, how are they falling apart at work? What they don't elucidate is how sensitive people are great problem solvers. And the fact that they pick up on such subtle nuances that they can actually be more holistic and have bring different perspectives to conversations because of the amount of detail they process at once. And so when we almost condemn a sensitive person in a high power situation because they're sensitive, it doesn't do great, because the flip side is they have a lot of things they bring to the table. And so all you have to now do is manage the anxiety or the sensitivity part, which has its tools. And now you're kind of at the cutting edge. You can actually bring so much more because it's actually a great skill that you don't even have to develop, because you're naturally very perceptive with these kinds of sensitivities. And I think that is a way to bring hope to that person. Go to medical school. It will be stressful. And also, you bring something so unique to the table. You connect with the patient differently. You can see so many different comorbidities that others might not even see to do a DDX a lot better. You could tell I was in that world for a while. Unfortunately, it was the thing that I was told, and I didn't go to medical school. And I was very intelligent. I was a geneticist. I was at the top of my class. I was being groomed to either go into PhD or MD, and it was too much for me, and I just didn't have those tools. Had I known them, I think my career would have been a little bit differently. Now, I don't wish that, because I get to still work with anxious people, but I think you get the picture that sensitive people are often told, no, this is too hard, or this is how it's supposed to be. And while that might be true, I do like to give them a little sense of empowerment, because there is a lot that you bring to the table by having sensory processing sensitivity. Sensitivity isn't a negative thing. It just means you're sensitive to more information at once. And that is an amazing thing.
That's beautiful. And I do think that that can often be true of healthcare providers who, you know, have a natural bent towards healing and emotional connection and just human connection, that relational element. So thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a strength. I think we need all the neurodiversity we can in healthcare, because all the patients are different. The cases are different. The stress load is different. And I think that making that career a lot less stressful for the provider will also make care a lot better. It'll nurture innovation in a hospital. One of the things that this publisher perish or hustle culture does is it stresses individuals out to the point of at the expense of innovation. Because we're thinking, oh, you know, they're being so productive. Look how many hours they're clocking. Sometimes if you just take a nap, you could think better. I don't know. maybe the solution isn't work more. Maybe the solution isn't grind gears until they're nubs. You know, maybe the solution is take a step back, take care of your body, and make this a sustainable career for the individual, and then show up. And it doesn't mean we have to be martyrs anymore. We do not have to, you know, work at the expense of our health. And it's very easy to do that even in entrepreneurship, which is a space I'm in now. It took a lot of deep programming for me to leave a corporate situation and come into entrepreneurship. Because when I started this, even I felt that I had to work all the time. I almost reverted, and I was like, wait a minute, you can create a lifestyle where you can work and be very productive, impact change, and also be healthy.
I mean, you're really speaking to transforming our core values, or coming back to those self-affirming and life-affirming core values that create sustainability, creativity, innovation, relationship, transformation. I'm loving it.
Yes. Yeah. The other thing that ends up being bypassed are the things people really, really love. Like, you shouldn't have to go on a vacation and be guilty that you're taking time off. You shouldn't feel like it's my career or my relationship with my husband or partner. It shouldn't be that way. It should be, how do I have this full round life where there is room for everything? I mean, if we really think about it, the people, take the president of the United States, they have the same 24 hours we do, and somehow they're running countries, right? So it puts a little perspective in, like, how do we leverage our 24 hours to have our version of a full rounded life?
Well, that really leads into my last question for you, which is, I mean, how do you do that? How do you keep yourself sustainable and connected with what is joy, like joy-giving or joyful in your own life?
What connects me to joy and makes it sustainable for me in my own life, it sounds cheesy, but I try to have a different relationship with anxiety than I think a lot of folks might have. And here's how I think of it. Anytime anxiety comes up, because it's still an emotion in our lexicon of emotions, right? I think of it as information. I always ask myself, what is it telling me that I'm out of alignment with? What's not working here? What is the friction point that is coming up? Because I've come to realize that anxiety is always telling us something, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. So when anxiety comes up, even with my clients, I'm like, okay, what was it? What were you anxious about? Because that's going to tell us now we're rubbed up right against the friction point. We can actually use it to determine how to shift the thing that's not working for us. And when we do that, we're just now constantly adjusting for a more joyful, more sustainable life, because you're constantly monitoring what that anxiety is communicating rather than condemning the anxiety itself. So it helps you relax, and it also helps you troubleshoot. So it's a life of inquiry, really, when you really shift that your relationship to anxiety.
Wow. It becomes a remarkable skill that helps you fine-tune and move towards joy and values, consistent action, and oh, I love that, sustainable life. Oh, well, thank you, Ramses. It was such an honor and such a pleasure to have you on Menders today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I have been, like I said, behind the scenes. I'm like, this is great. I love everything you're doing. And so thank you for having me here. It's such a pleasure to chat with you and to all your listeners.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.